to worm their way into your trust, so they might betray your grace at the first chance.
Then they failed. I do not trust them. I will never trust them.
If truth be told, Danae was forgetting how to trust.
We can still use them. One was a woman, Maris. Send her back as a gesture of my regard. If their captain is a clever man, he will understand.
The woman is the worst of all.
All the better.
Danny considered a moment.
We should sound out the Long Lancers, too, and the company of the cat.
Bloodbeard, Sir Barristan's frown deepened. If it please your grace, we want no part of him. Your grace is too young to remember the Ninepenny Kings, but this Bloodbeard is cut from the same savage cloth. There is no honour in him, only hunger for gold, for glory, for blood.
You know more of such men than I, sir.
If Bloodbeard were truly the most dishonourable and greedy of the sellswords, he might be the easiest to sway. But she was loath to go against Sir Barristan's counsel in such matters.
Do as you think best, but do it soon. If Histar's peace should break, I want to be ready. I do not trust the slavers.
I do not trust my husband.
They will turn on us at the first sign of weakness.
The young kye grow weaker as well. The bloody flox has taken hold amongst the Tlothi, it is said, and spread across the river to the 3rd Giscari Legion.
The Pale Mare,
Daenerys sighed.
Quaithe warned me of the Pale Mare's coming. She told me of the Dornish Prince as well, the Sun's Son. She told me much and more, but all in riddles. I cannot rely on plague to save me from my enemies. Set pretty Maris free at once.
As you command, though, your grace, if I may be so bold, there is another road.
The Dornish Road,
Danny sighed. The three Dornishmen had been at the feast, as befit Prince Quentin's rank, though Resnick had taken care to seat them as far as possible from her husband. Histar did not seem to be of a jealous nature, but no man would be pleased by the presence of a rival suitor near his new bride.
The boy seems pleasant and well-spoken, but
Huss Martell is ancient and noble, and has been a leal friend to Huss Tregarion for more than a century, your grace. I had the honour of serving with Prince Quentin's great-uncle in your father's Seven. Prince Lewin was as valiant a brother-in-arms as any man could wish for. Quentin Martell is of the same blood, if it please your grace.
It would please me if he had turned up with these 50,000 swords he speaks of. Instead, he brings two knights and a parchment. Will a parchment shield my people from the Yunkai? If he had come with a fleet,
Sunspear has never been a sea power, your grace.
No.
Danny knew enough of Westerosi history to know that. Nymeria had landed 10,000 ships upon Dorne's sandy shores, but when she wed her Dornish prince, she had burned them all and turned her back upon the sea forever.
Dorne is too far away. To please this prince, I would need to abandon all my people. You should send him home.
Dornishmen are notoriously stubborn, your grace. Prince Quentin's forebears fought your own for the better part of 200 years. He will not go without you.
Then he will die here, Daenerys thought, unless there is more to him than I can see. Is he still within?
Drinking with his knights.
Bring him to me. It is time he met my children.
A flicker of doubt passed across the long, solemn face of Barristan Selmy. As you command. Her king was laughing with Yerkaz O'Yunsek and the other Yankish lords. Danny did not think that he would miss her, but just in case she instructed her handmaids to tell him that she was answering a call of nature, should he inquire after her. Sir Barristan was waiting by the steps with the Dornish prince.
Martell's square face was flushed and ruddy. "Too much wine," the Queen concluded, though he was doing the best to conceal that. Apart from the line of copper suns that ornamented his belt, the Dornishman was plainly dressed.
"They call him Frog,"
Danny recalled. She could see why. He was not a handsome man. She smiled.
"My prince, it's a long way down. Are you certain that you wish to do this?"
"If it would please your grace."
"Then come."
A pair of unsullied went down the steps before them, bearing torches. Behind came two brazen beasts, one masked as a fish, the other as a hawk. Even here in her own pyramid, on this happy night of peace and celebration, Sir Barristan insisted on keeping guards about her everywhere she went. The small company made the long descent in silence, stopping thrice to refresh themselves along the way.
"The dragon has three heads,"
Danny said, when they were on the final flight.
"My marriage need not be the end of all your hopes. I know why you're here." "For you," said Quentin, all awkward gallantry. "No," said Danny, "for fire and blood."
One of the elephants trumpeted at them from his stall. An answering roar from below made her flush with sudden heat. Prince Quentin looked up in alarm.
"The dragons know when she is near," Sir Barristan told him.
"Every child knows its mother," Danny thought. "When the seas go dry and mountains blow in the wind like leaves, they call to me. Come."
She took Prince Quentin by the hand and led him to the pit where two of her dragons were confined.
"Remain outside,"
Danny told Sir Barristan, as the unsullied were opening the huge iron doors.
"Prince Quentin will protect me."
She drew the Dornish prince inside with her to stand above the pit. The dragons craned their necks around, gazing at them with burning eyes. Viserion had shattered one chain and melted the others. He clung to the roof of the pit like some huge white bat. His claws dug deep into the burnt and crumbling bricks. Rhaegal, still chained, was gnawing on the carcass of a bull. The bones on the floor of the pit were deeper than the last time she had been down here, and the walls and floors were black and grey, more ash than brick. They would not hold much longer, but behind them was only earth and stone.
"Can dragons tunnel through rock, like the fireworms of old Valyria?"
She hoped not. The Dornish prince had gone as white as milk.
I had heard that there were three. A Drogon is hunting."
He did not need to hear the rest.
"The white one is Viserion. The green is Rhaegal. I named them for my brothers."
Her voice echoed off the scorched stone walls. It sounded small. A girl's voice, not the voice of a queen and conqueror, nor the glad voice of a new-made bride. Rhaegal roared in answer, and fire filled the pit. A spear of red and yellow. Viserion replied, his own flames gold and orange. When he flapped his wings, a cloud of grey ash filled the air. Broken chains clanked and clattered about his legs. Quentin Martell jumped back a foot. A crueler woman might have laughed at him, but Danny squeezed his hand and said,
"They frighten me as well. There is no shame in that. My children have grown wild and angry in the dark."
You mean to ride them?"
"One of them. All I know of dragons is what my brother told me when I was a girl, and some I read in books, but it is said that even Aegon the Conqueror never dared mount Vhagar or Meraxes, nor did his sisters ride Beleriand the Black Dread. Dragons live longer than men, some for hundreds of years, so Beleriand had other riders after Aegon died, but no rider ever flew two dragons."
Viserion hissed again. Smoke rose between his teeth, and deep down in his throat
they could see gold fire churning. They are fearsome creatures.
They are dragons, Quentin.
Danny stood on her toes and kissed him lightly, once on each cheek.
And so am I.
The young prince swallowed. I have the blood of the dragon in me as well, your grace. I can trace my lineage back to the first Daenerys, the Targaryen princess, who was sister to King Daeron the Good, and wife to the Prince of Dorne. He built the water gardens for her.
The water gardens?
She knew little and less of Dorne or its history, if truth be told. My father's favourite palace. It would please me to show them to you one day. They are all of pink marble, with pools and fountains overlooking the sea.
They sound lovely.
She drew him away from the pit.
He does not belong here. He should never have come. You ought to return there. My court is no safe place for you, I fear. You have more enemies than you know. You made Dario look a fool, and he's not a man to forget such a slight.
I have my knights, my sworn shields.
Two knights. Dario has 500 storm crows. And you would do well to beware of my lord husband, too. He seems a mild and pleasant man, I know, but do not be deceived. His star's crown derives from mine, and he commands the allegiance of some of the most fearsome fighters in the world. If one of them should think to win his favour by disposing of a rival...
I am a prince of Dorne, your grace. I will not run from slaves and sellswords.
Then you truly are a fool, Prince Frog.
Danny gave her wild children one last lingering look. She could hear the dragon screaming as she led the boy back to the door and see the play of light against the bricks, reflections of their fires.
If I look back, I am lost. Sir Barristan will have summoned a pair of sedan chairs to carry us back up to the banquet, but the climb can still be wearisome.
Behind them, the great iron doors closed with a resounding clang.
Tell me of this other Daenerys. I know less than I should of the history of my father's kingdom. I never had a maester growing up, only a brother.
It would be my pleasure, your grace, said Quentin. It was well past midnight before the last of their guests took their leave, and Dany retired to her own apartments to join her lord and king. His Dar at least was happy, if somewhat drunk.
I keep my promises, he told her, as Iri and Jiqui were robing them for bed. You wished for peace, and it is yours. And you wish for blood, and soon enough I must give it to you, Danny thought.
But what she said was,
I am grateful.
The excitement of the day had inflamed her husband's passions. No sooner had her handmaids retired for the night than he tore the robe from her and tumbled her backwards into bed. Danny slid her arms around him and let him have his way. Drunk as he was, she knew he would not be inside her long. Nor was he. Afterward, he nuzzled at her ear and whispered, God's grant that we have made a son tonight. The words of Miri Mazdur rang in her head. When the sun rises in the west and sets in the east, when the seas go dry and mountains blow in the wind like leaves, when your womb quickens again and you bear a living child, then he will return, and not before. The meaning was plain enough. Khal Drogo was as like to return from the dead as she was to bear a living child. But there are some secrets she could not bring herself to share, even with a husband. So she let Hisdar Zoloric keep his hopes. Her noble husband was soon fast asleep. Daenerys could only twist and turn beside him. She wanted to shake him, wake him, make him hold her, kiss her, fuck her again. But even if he did, he would fall back to sleep again afterwards, leaving her alone in the darkness.
She wondered what Dario was doing. Was he restless as well? Was he thinking about her? Did he love her, truly? Did he hate her for marrying Hisdar?
I should never have taken him into my bed.
He was only a sellsword, no fit consort for a queen, and yet...
I knew that all along, but I did it anyway.
My queen,
said a soft voice in the darkness. Danny flinched.
Who is there? Only Miss Andy.
The Nathi scribe moved closer to the bed.
This one heard you crying.
Crying? I was not crying. Why would I cry? I have my peace. I have my king. I have everything a queen might wish for. He had a bad dream, that was all.
As you say, your grace.
She bowed and made to go.
Stay, said Danny. I do not wish to be alone. His grace is with you,
Miss Andy pointed out.
His grace is dreaming, but I cannot sleep. On the morrow I must bathe in blood, the price of peace.
She smiled wanly and patted the bed.
Come, sit. Talk with me. If it please you.
Miss Andy sat down beside her.
What shall we talk of? Home, said Danny. Nath, butterflies and brothers. Tell me of the things that make you happy, the things that make you giggle. All your sweetest memories. Remind me that there is still good in the world.
Miss Andy did her best. She was still talking when Danny finally fell to sleep, to dream queer, half-formed dreams of smoke and fire. The morning came too soon.
Theon. One moment he was asleep, the next awake. Kyra nestled against him, one arm draped lightly over his, her breast brushing his back. He could hear her breathing, soft and steady. The sheet was tangled about them. It was the black of night. The bedchamber was dark and still.
What is it? Did I hear something? Someone?
Wind sighed faintly against the shutters. Somewhere far off he heard the yowl of a cat in heat. Nothing else.
Sleep. Greyjoy, he told himself. The castle is quiet, and you have guards posted. At your door, at the gates, on the armory.
He might have put it down to a bad dream, but he did not remember dreaming. Kyra had worn him out. Until Theon had sent for her, she had lived all her 18 years in the winter town without ever setting foot inside the walls of a castle. She came to him wet and eager and lithe as a weasel. And there had been a certain undeniable spice to fucking a common tavern wench in Lord Eddard Stark's own bed. She murmured sleepily as Theon slid out from under her arm and got to his feet. A few embers still smouldered in the hearth. Wex slept on the floor at the foot of the bed, rolled up inside his cloak and dead to the world. Nothing moved. Theon crossed to the window and threw open the shutters. Night touched him with cold fingers, and goose prickles rose on his bare skin. He leaned against the stone sill and looked out on the dark towers, empty yards, black sky, and more stars than a man could ever count if he lived to be 100. A half-moon floated above the bell tower and cast its reflection on the roof of the glass gardens. He heard no alarums, no voices, not so much as a footfall.
All's well, Greyjoy. Hear the quiet. You ought to be drunk with joy. You took Winterfell with fewer than 30 men, a feat to sing of.
Theon started back to bed. He'd roll Kyra on her back and fuck her again. That ought to banish these phantoms. Her gasps and giggles would make a welcome respite from this silence. He stopped. He had grown so used to the howling of the direwolves that he scarcely heard it any more. But some part of him, some hunter's instinct, heard its absence.
Erzin stood outside his door.
a sinewy man with a round shield slung over his back. "The wolves are quiet," Theon told him. "Go see what they're doing, and come straight back." The thought of the dire wolves running loose gave him a queasy feeling. He remembered the day in the wolf's wood when the wildlings had attacked Bran. Summer and Grey Wind had torn them to pieces. When he prodded Wex with the toe of his boot, the boy sat up and rubbed his eyes. "Make certain Bran Stark and his little brother are in their beds, and be quick about it."
"My lord," Kyra called sleepily.
"Go back to sleep. This does not concern you." Theon poured himself a cup of wine and drank it down. All the time he was listening, hoping to hear a howl. "Too few men," he thought sourly. "I have too few men. If Asha does not come." Wex returned the quickest, shaking his head from side to side. Cursing, Theon found his tunic and breeches on the floor where he had dropped them in his haste to get at Kyra. Over the tunic he donned a jerkin of iron-studded leather, and he belted a long sword and dagger at his waist. His hair was wild as the wood, but he had larger concerns. By then Erzin was back.
"The wolves be gone."
Theon told himself he must be as cold and deliberate as Lord Eddard. "Rouse the castle," he said. "Herd them out into the yard, everyone. We'll see who's missing. And have Lauren make a round of the gates. Wex, with me." He wondered if Stig had reached Deepwood Mott yet. The man was not as skilled a rider as he claimed. None of the Iron Men were much good in the saddle. But there had been time enough. Asher might well be on her way.
"And if she learns that I have lost the Starks..."
It did not bear thinking about. Bran's bedchamber was empty, as was Rickon's half a turn below. Theon cursed himself. He should have kept a guard on them, but he deemed it more important to have men walking the walls and protecting the gates than to nursemaid a couple of children, one a cripple. Outside he heard sobbing as the castle folk were pulled from their beds and driven into the yard.
"I'll give them reason to sob. I've used them gently, and this is how they repay me."
He'd even had two of his own men whipped bloody for raping the kennel girl to show them he meant to be just.
"They still blame me for the rape, though, and the rest."
He deemed that unfair. Micken had killed himself with his mouth, just as Benfred had. As for Shale, he had to give someone to the drowned guard. His men expected it. "I bear you no ill will," he told the Septon, before they threw him down the well. "But you and your guards have no place here now." You'd think the others would be grateful he hadn't chosen one of them, but no. He wondered how many of them were part of this plot against him. Erzin returned with Black Lauren.
"The Hunter's Gate," Lauren said. "Best come see."
The Hunter's Gate was conveniently sited close to the kennels and kitchens. It opened directly on fields and forests, allowing riders to come and go without first passing through the winter town, and so was favoured by hunting parties.
"Who had the guard here?"
Theon demanded.
"Drennan and Squint."
Drennan was one of the men who'd raped Parla.
"If they let the boys escape, I'll have more than a little skin off their backs this time. I swear it."
"No need for that,"
Black Lauren said curtly. Nor was there. They found Squint floating face down in the moat, his entrails drifting behind him like a nest of pale snakes. Drennan lay half-naked in the gatehouse, in the snug room, where the drawbridge was worked. His throat had been open ear to ear. A ragged tunic concealed the half-heel scars on his back, but his boots were scattered amidst the rushes, and his breeches tangled about his feet. There was cheese on a small table near the door, beside an empty flagon and two cups. Theon picked one up and sniffed at the dregs of wine in the bottom.
"Squint was up on the wall walk, no?"
"Aye," said Lauren.
Theon flung the cup into the hearth.
"I'd say Drennan was pulling down his breeches to stick it in the woman when she stuck it in him. His own cheese knife, by the look of it. Someone find a pike and fish the other fool out of the moat."
The other fool was in a deal worse shape than Drennan. When Black Lauren drew him out of the water. They saw that one of his arms had been wrenched off at the elbow. Half of his neck was missing, and there was a ragged hole where his navel and groin had once been. The pike tore through his bowels as Lauren was pulling him in. The stench was awful. "The direwolves," Theon said. "Both of them, at a guess." Disgusted, he walked back to the drawbridge. Winterfell was encircled by two massive granite walls with a wide moat between them. The outer wall stood 80 feet high, the inner more than 100. Lacking men, Theon had been forced to abandon the outer defences and post his guards along the higher inner walls. He dared not risk having them on the wrong side of the moat should the castle rise against him. There had to be two more, he decided. While the woman was entertaining Drennan, the others freed the wolves. Theon called for a torch and led them up the steps to the wall walk. He swept the flame low before him, looking for... there! On the inside of the rampart, in the wide crenel between two upthrust merlins. "Blood," he announced. "Clumsily mopped up. At a guess, the woman killed Drennan and lowered the drawbridge. Squint heard the clank of chains, came to have a look, and got this far. They pushed the corpse through the crenel into the moat so he wouldn't be found by another sentry." Erzan peered along the walls.
"The other watch turrets and a fire. I see torches burning."
"Torches, but no guards," Theon said testily. "Winterfell has more turrets than I have men." "Four guards at the main gate," said Black Lauren, "and five walking the walls beside Squint." Erzan said,
"If he had sounded his horn..."
"I'm served by fools." "Try and imagine it was you up there, Erzan. It's dark and cold. You have been walking sentry for hours, looking forward to the end of your watch. Then you hear a noise and you move forward to the gate, and suddenly you see eyes at the top of the stair, glowing green and gold in the torchlight. Two shadows come rushing toward you, faster than you can believe. You catch a glimpse of teeth, start to level your spear, and they slam into you and open your belly, tearing through leather as if it was cheesecloth." He gave Erzan a hard shove. "And now you're down on your back. Your guts are spilling out, and one of them has his teeth round your neck." Theon grabbed the man's scrawny throat, tightening his fingers and smiled. "Tell me, at what moment, during all of this, do you stop to blow your fucking horn?" He shoved Erzan away roughly, sending him stumbling back against a merlin. The man rubbed his throat. "I should have had those beasts put down the day we took the castle," he saw angrily. "I'd seen them kill. I knew how dangerous they were."
"We must go after them," Black Lauren said.
Not in the dark. Theon did not relish the idea of chasing direwolves through the wood by night. The hunters could easily become the hunted. "We'll wait for daylight. Until then, I'd best go speak with my loyal subjects." Down in the yard, an uneasy crowd of men, women, and children had been pushed up against the wall. Many had not been given time to dress. They covered themselves with woolen blankets or huddled naked under cloaks or bedrobes. A dozen iron men hemmed them in, torches in one hand and weapons in the other. The wind was gusting, and the flickering orange light reflected dully off steel helms, thick beards, and unsmiling eyes. Theon walked up and down before the prisoners, studying the faces. They all looked guilty to him. "How many are missing?"
"Six."
Reek stepped up behind him, smelling of soap, his long hair moving in the wind.
"Bullstarks, that bug boy and his sister, the half-wit from the stable, and your wildling woman."
Usher. He had suspected her from the moment he saw that second cup. "I should have known better than to trust that one. She's as unnatural as Asher. Even their names sound alike. Has anyone had a look at the stables?"
"Igar says no horses are missing."
"Dancer is still in his stall?"
"Dancer?" Reek frowned. "Igar says the horses are all there. Only the half-wit is missing."
They're afoot, then. That was the best news he'd heard since he woke. Bran would be riding in his basket, on Hodor's back, no doubt. Usher would need to carry Rickon. His little legs wouldn't take him far on their own. Theon was confident that he'd soon have them back in his hands. "Bran and Rickon have fled," he told the castle folk, watching their eyes. "Who knows where they've gone?" No one answered. "They could not have escaped without help," Theon went on. "Without food, clothing, weapons." He'd locked away every sword and axe in Winterfell, but no doubt some had been hidden from him. "I'll have the names of all those who aided them. All those who turned a blind eye." The only sound was the wind. "Come first light. I mean to bring them back." He hooked his thumb through his sword belt. "I need huntsmen. Who wants a nice warm wolfskin to see them through the winter? Gage?" The cook had always greeted him cheerfully when he returned from the hunt to ask whether he'd brought anything choice for the table, but he had nothing to say now. Theon walked back the way he'd come, searching their faces for the least sign of guilty knowledge. "The wild is no place for a cripple. And Rickon, young as he is, how long will he last out there? Nan, think how frightened he must be." The old woman had nattered at him for 10 years, telling her endless stories, but now she gaped at him as if he were some stranger. "I might have killed every man of you and given your women to my soldiers for their pleasure, but instead I protected you. Is this the thanks you offer?" Joseph, who'd groomed his horses, Farlan, who taught him all he knew of hounds, Barth, the brewer's wife, who'd been his first, none of them would meet his eyes. "They hate me," he realized. Reek stepped close. "Strip off their skins," he urged, his thick lips glistening. "Lord Bolton, he used to say, a naked man has few secrets, but a flayed man's got none." The flayed man was the sigil of House Bolton, Theon knew. Ages past, certain of their lords had gone so far as to cloak themselves in the skins of dead enemies. A number of Starks had ended thus. Supposedly all that had stopped 1,000 years ago, when the Boltons had bent their knees to Winterfell. Or so they say, but always die hard, as well I know. "There will be no flaying in the North so long as I rule in Winterfell," Theon said loudly. "I am your only protection against the likes of him," he wanted to scream. He could not be that blatant, but perhaps some of them were clever enough to take the lesson. The sky was greying over the castle walls. Dawn could not be far off. "Joseph, saddle Smiler, and a horse for yourself. Murch, Garrus, Poxy Tim, you'll come as well." Murch and Garrus were the best huntsmen in the castle, and Tim was a fine bowman. "Aegar, Red Nose, Gelmar, Reek, Wex." He needed his own to watch his back. "Fardon, I want hounds, and you to handle them." The grizzled kennel master crossed his arms.
"And why would I care to hunt down my own true-born lords and babes at that?"
Theon moved close. "I am your true-born lord now, and a man who keeps Parla safe." He saw the defiance die in Farland's eyes.
"Aye, my lord."
Stepping back, Theon glanced about to see who else he might add.
"Maester Lewin," he announced. "I know nothing of hunting."
"No, but I don't trust you in a castle in my absence."
"Then it's past time you learned." "Let me come too. I want that wolfskin cloak."
A boy stepped forward, no older than Bran. It took Theon a moment to remember him.
"I've hunted lots of times before," Waldo Frey said. "Red deer and elk and even boar."
His cousin laughed at him.
"He rode in a boar hunt with his father, but they never let him near the boar."
Theon looked at the boy doubtfully.
"Come if you like, but if you can't keep up, don't think that I'll nurse you along."
He turned back to Black Lauren.
"Winterfell is yours in my absence. If we do not return, do with it as you will."
"That bloody well ought to have them
praying for my success.
They assembled by the hunter's gate as the first pale rays of the sun brushed the top of the bell tower, their breaths frosting in the cold morning air. Gelmar had equipped himself with a long axe whose reach would allow him to strike before the wolves were on him. The blade was heavy enough to kill with a single blow. Aegar wore steel greaves. Reek arrived carrying a boar spear and an overstuffed washerwoman's sack bulging with God knows what. Theon had his bow. He needed nothing else. Once he had saved Bran's life with an arrow, he hoped he would not need to take it with another. But if it came to that, he would. 11 men, 2 boys, and 12 dogs crossed the moat. Beyond the outer wall, the tracks were plain to read in the soft ground. The paw prints of the wolves, Hodor's heavy tread, the shallower marks left by the feet of the 2 reeds. Once under the trees, the stony ground and fallen leaves made the trail harder to see, but by then Farland's red bitch had the scent. The rest of the dogs were close behind, the hounds sniffing and barking, a pair of monstrous mastiffs bringing up the rear. Their size and ferocity might make the difference against a cornered direwolf. He'd have guessed that Usher might have run south to Sir Roderick, but the trail led north by northwest into the very heart of the wolf's wood. Theon did not like that one bit. It would have been a bitter irony if the Starks had made for Deepwood Mutt and delivered themselves right into Asher's hands. I'd sooner have them dead, he thought bitterly. It is better to be seen as cruel than foolish. Wisps of pale mist threaded between the trees. Sentinels and soldier pines grew thicker about here, and there was nothing as dark and gloomy as an evergreen forest. The ground was uneven, and the fallen needles disguised the softness of the turf and made the footing treacherous for the horses, so they had to go slowly. Not so slowly as a man carrying a cripple, though, or a bony harridan with a 4-year-old on her back. He told himself to be patient. He'd have them before the day was out. Maester Lewin trotted up to him as they were following a game trail along the lip of a ravine.
Thus far, hunting seems indistinguishable from riding through the woods, my lord.
Theon smiled.
There are similarities, but with hunting, there's blood at the end. Must it be so? This flight was great folly. But will you not be merciful? These are your foster brothers we seek.
No Stark but Rob was ever brotherly toward me, but Bran and Rickon have more value to me living than dead.
The same is true of the reeds. Moat Cailin sits on the edge of the bogs. Lord Howland can make your uncle's occupation a visit to hell if he chooses, but so long as you hold his ears, he must stay his head.
Theon had not considered that. In truth, he had scarcely considered the mudmen at all, beyond eyeing Mira once or twice and wondering if she was still a maiden.
You may be right. We will spare them if we can. And Hodor, too, I hope. The boy is simple, you know that. He does as he's told. How many times has he groomed your horse, soaped your saddle, scoured your mail?
Hodor was nothing to him.
If he does not fight us, we will let him live.
Theon pointed a finger. But say one word about sparing the wildling, and you can die with her.
She swore me an oath, and pissed on it.
The maester inclined his head.
I make no apologies for oath-breakers. Do what you must. I thank you for your mercy.
Mercy, thought Theon, as Lewin dropped back. There's a bloody trap. Too much, and they call you weak, too little, and you're monstrous. Yet the maester had given him good counsel, he knew. His father thought only in terms of conquest, but what good was it to take a kingdom if you could not hold it? Force and fear could carry you only so far. A pity Ned Stark had taken his daughter south. Elsewise, Theon could have tightened his grip on Winterfell by marrying one of them.
Sansa was a pretty little thing, too, and by now likely even ripe for bedding.
But she was 1,000 leagues away, in the clutches of the Lannisters. A shame. The wood grew ever wilder. The pines and sentinels gave way to huge dark oaks. Tangles of hawthorn concealed treacherous gullies and cuts. Stony hills rose and fell. They passed a crofter's cottage, deserted and overgrown, and skirted a flooded quarry where the still water had a sheen as grey as steel. When the dogs began to bay, Theon figured the fugitives were near at hand. He spurred Smiler and followed at a trot. But what he found was only the carcass of a young elk, or what remained of it. He dismounted for a closer look. The kill was still fresh, and plainly the work of wolves. The dog sniffed around it eagerly, and one of the mastiffs buried his teeth into a haunch until Farlan shouted him off. "No part of this animal has been butchered," Theon realized. "The wolves ate, but not the men." Even if Usher did not want to risk a fire, she ought to have cut them a few steaks. It made no sense to leave so much good meat to rot. "Farlan, are you certain we're on the right trail?" he demanded. "Could your dogs be chasing the wrong wolves?"
"My bitch knows the smell of Summer and Shaggy well enough."
"I hope so, for your sake." Less than an hour later, the trail led down a slope toward a muddy brook swollen by the recent rains. It was there the dogs lost the scent. Farlan and Wex waded across with the hounds and came back shaking their heads, while the animals ranged up and down the far bank sniffing.
"They went in here, my lord, but I can't see where they come out," the kennel master said.
Theon dismounted and knelt beside the stream. He dipped a hand in it. The water was cold.
"They won't have stayed long in this," he said. "Take off the dogs downstream. I'll go up."
Wex clapped his hands together loudly.
"What is it?"
Theon said. The mute boy pointed. The ground near the water was sodden and muddy. The tracks the wolves had left were plain enough.
"Paw prints, yes. So?"
Wex drove his heel into the mud and pivoted his foot this way and that. It left a deep gouge. Joseph understood.
"A man the size of Hodor ought to have left a deep print in this mud," he said. "More so with the weight of a boy on his back. Yet the only boot prints here are our own. See for yourself."
Appalled, Theon saw it was true. The wolves had gone into the turgid brown water alone.
"Usher must have turned aside, back of us. Before the elk, most likely. She sent the wolves on by themselves, hoping we'd chase after them."
He rounded on his huntsman.
"If you two have played me false."
"There's been only the one trail, my lord, I swear it," said Garrus defensively. "And the direwolves would never have parted from them boys, not for long." "That's so," Theon thought.
Summer and Shaggy Dog might have gone off to hunt, but soon or late they would return to Bran and Rickon.
"Garrus, Murch, take four dogs and double back. Find where we lost them. Agar, you watch them. I'll have no trickery. Farlan and I will follow the direwolves. Give a blast on your horn when you pick up the trail. Two blasts if you catch sight of the beasts themselves. Once we find out where they went, they'll lead us back to their masters."
He took Wex, the Frey boy, and Ginner Rednose to search upstream. He and Wex rode on one side of the brook, Rednose and Walder Frey on the other, each with a pair of hounds. The wolves might have come out on either bank. Theon kept an eye out for tracks, spoor, broken branches, any hint as to where the direwolves might have left the water. He spied the prints of deer, elk, and badger easily enough. Wex surprised a vixen drinking at the stream, and Walder flushed three rabbits from the underbrush and managed to put an arrow in one. They saw the claw marks where a bear had shredded the bark of a tall birch, but of the direwolves there was no sign.
"A little farther," Theon told himself. "Past that oak, over that rise, past the next bend of the stream, we'll find something there."
He pressed on, long after he knew he should turn back, a growing sense of anxiety gnawing at his belly. It was midday when he wrenched Smiler's head around in disgust and gave up. Somehow Usher and the wretched boys were eluding him. It should not have been possible, not on foot, burdened with a cripple and a young child. Every passing hour increased the likelihood that they would make good their escape. If they reach a village, the people of the north would never deny Ned Stark's sons, Rob's brothers. They'd have mounts to speed them on their way, food. Men would fight for the honor of protecting them. The whole bloody north would rally around them. The walls went downstream, that's all. He clung to the thought. That red bitch will sniff where they came out of the water and will be after them again. But when they joined up with Farland's party, one look at the kennel master's face smashed all of Theon's hopes to shards. The only thing those dogs are fit for is a bear baiting, he said angrily. Would that I had a bear. The dogs are not at fault. Farland knelt between a mastiff and his precious red bitch, a hand on each. Running water don't hold no sense, my lord. The wolves had to come out of the stream somewhere. No doubt they did, upstream or down. We keep on. We'll find the place, but which way? I never knew a wolf to run up a stream bed for miles, said Reek. A man might, if he knew he was being hunted. He might. But a wolf? Yet Theon wondered. These beasts were not as other wolves. I should have skinned the cursed things. It was the same tale all over again when they rejoined Garrus, Murch, and Aegar. The huntsmen had retraced their steps halfway to Winterfell, without finding any sign of where the Starks might have parted company with the direwolves. Farland's hounds seemed as frustrated as their masters, sniffing forlornly at trees and rocks, and snapping irritably at each other. Theon dared not admit defeat. We'll return to the brook. Search again. This time we'll go as far as we must. We won't find them, the Frey boy said suddenly. Not so long as the frog eaters are with them. Mudmen are sneaks. They won't fight like decent folk. They'll skulk and use poison arrows. You never see them, but they see you. Those who go into the bogs after them get lost and never come out. Their houses move, even the castles like Greywater Watch. He glanced nervously at greenery that encircled them on all sides. They might be out there right now, listening to everything we say. Farden laughed to show what he thought of that notion.
Or my dogs would smell anything in them bushes. Be all over them before you could break wind, boy.
Frog-eaters don't smell like men, Frey insisted. They have a boggy stink, like frogs and trees and scummy water. Moss grows under their arms in place of air, and they can live with nothing to eat but mud and breathe swamp water.
Theon was about to tell him what he ought to do with his wet nurse's fable, when Maester Lewin spoke up.
The histories say the Crannog men who grew close to the children of the forest in the days when the green seers tried to bring the hammer of the waters down upon the neck. It may be they have secret knowledge.
Suddenly the wood seemed a deal darker than it had a moment before, as if a cloud had passed before the sun. It was one thing to have some fool boy spouting folly, but maesters were supposed to be wise. "The only children that concern me are Bran and Rickon," Theon said. "Back to the stream, now." For a moment he did not think they were going to obey, but in the end old habit asserted itself. They followed sullenly, but they followed. The Frey boy was as jumpy as those rabbits he'd flushed earlier. Theon put men on either bank and followed the current. They rode for miles, going slow and careful, dismounting to lead the horses over treacherous ground, letting the good-for-bear-bait hounds sniff at every bush. Where a fallen tree dammed the flow, the hunters were forced to loop around a deep green pool. But if the direwolves had done the same, they'd left neither print nor spore. The beasts had taken to swimming, it seemed.
When I catch them, they'll have all the swimming they can stomach. I'll give them both to the drowned god.
When the woods began to darken, Theon Greyjoy knew he was beaten. Either the Crannog men did know the magic of the Children of the Forest, or else Usher had deceived them with some wilding trick. He made them press on through the dusk, but when the last light faded, Joseph finally worked up the courage to say, "This is fruitless, my lord. We will lame a horse, break a leg."
"Joseph has the right of it," said Maester Lewin. "Groping through the woods by torchlight will avail us nothing."
Theon could taste bile at the back of his throat, and his stomach was a nest of snakes twining and snapping at each other. If he crept back to Winterfell empty-handed, he might as well dress in motley henceforth and wear a pointed hat. The whole North would know him for a fool. "And when my father hears, an usher."
"My lord prince," Reek urged his horse near, "might be them Starks never came this way. If I was them, I would have gone north and east, maybe, to the Umbers. Good Stark men they are. But their lands are a long way. The boys would shelter someplace nearer. Might be, I know where."
Theon looked at him suspiciously. "Tell me."
"You know that old mill, sitting lonely, on the Acorn Water? We stopped there when I was being dragged to Winterfell a captive. The miller's wife sold us hay for our horses, while that old knight clucked over her brats. Might be the Starks ride in there."
Theon knew the mill. He had even tumbled the miller's wife a time or two. There was nothing special about it, or her. "Why there? There are a dozen villages and Holdfast just as close." Amusement shone in those pale eyes.
"Why? Now that's past knowing. But they're there. I've a feeling."
He was growing sick of this man's sly answers.
"His lips look like two worms fucking."
"What are you saying? If you've kept some knowledge from me." "My lord prince," Reek dismounted and beckoned Theon to do the same. When they were both afoot, he pulled open the cloth sack he'd fetched from Winterfell.
"Have a look here."
It was growing hard to see. Theon thrust his hand into the sack impatiently, groping amongst soft fur and rough, scratchy wool. A sharp point pricked his skin, and his fingers closed around something cold and hard. He drew out a wolf's head brooch, silver and jet. Understanding came suddenly. His hand closed into a fist.
"Kilmar,"
he said, wondering whom he could trust.
"None of them.
Aegar, Red Nose, with us. The rest of you may return to Winterfell with the hounds. I have no further need of them. I know where Bran and Rickon are hiding now."
"Prince Theon," Maester Lewin entreated, "you will remember your promise. Mercy, you said."
"Mercy was for this morning," said Theon.
"It is better to be feared than laughed at.
Before they made me angry." Catelyn. The drums were pounding, 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 and her head with them. Pipes wailed and flutes trilled from the musicians' gallery at the foot of the hall. Fiddles screeched, horns blew, the skins skirled a lively tune, but the drumming drove them all. The sounds echoed off the rafters while the guests ate, drank, and shouted at one another below. Walder Frey must be deaf as a stone to call this music. Catelyn sipped a cup of wine and watched Jingle Bell prance to the sounds of Alysanne. At least she thought it was meant to be Alysanne. With these players, it might as easily have been the Bear and the Maiden Fair. Outside, the rain still fell, but within the twins the air was thick and hot. A fire roared in the hearth, and rows of torches burned smokily from their iron sconces on the walls. Yet most of the heat came off the bodies of the wedding guests, jammed in so thick along the benches that every man who tried to lift his cup poked his neighbour in the ribs. Even on the dais, they were closer than Catelyn would have liked. She had been placed between Sir Ryman Frey and Roose Bolton, and had gotten a good noseful of both. Sir Ryman drank as if Westeros was about to run short of wine, and sweated it all out under his arms. He had bathed in lemon water, she judged, but no lemon could mask so much sour sweat. Roose Bolton had a sweeter smell to him, yet no more pleasant. He sipped hippocras in preference to wine or mead, and ate but little. Catelyn could not fault him for his lack of appetite. The wedding feast began with a thin leek soup, followed by a salad of green beans, onions, and beets. River pike poached in almond milk, mounds of mashed turnips that were cold before they reached the table, jellied calves' brains, and a leash of stringy beef. It was poor fare to set before a king, and the calves' brains turned Catelyn's stomach. Yet Rob ate it, uncomplaining, and her brother was too caught up with his bride to pay much attention. You would never guess Edmure complained of Roslyn all the way from River Run to the Twins. Husband and wife ate from a single plate, drank from a single cup, and exchanged chaste kisses between sips. Most of the dishes Edmure waved away. She could not blame him for that. She remembered little of the food served at her own wedding feast. Did I even taste it? Or spend the whole time gazing at Ned's face, wondering who he was? Poor Rosalind's smile had a fixed quality to it, as if someone had sewn it onto her face. Well, she is a maid wedded, but the bedding's yet to come. No doubt she's as terrified as I was. Rob was seated between Alex Frey and Fair Walder, two of the more nubile Frey maidens.
At the wedding feast, I hope you will not refuse to dance with my daughters, eh?
Walter Frey had said.
It will please an old man's heart, eh?
His heart should be well pleasing. Rob had done his duty like a king. He had danced with each of the girls, with Edmure's bride and the Eighth Lady Frey, with the widow Amy and Roose Bolton's wife, Fat Walder, with the pimply twins, Sarah and Sari, even with Shirai, Lord Walder's youngest, who must have been all of six. Catelyn wondered whether the Lord of the Crossing would be satisfied, or if he would find cause for complaint in all the other daughters and granddaughters who had not had a turn with the king. "Your sisters dance very well," she said to Sir Ryman Frey, trying to be pleasant.
"They're aunts and cousins."
Sir Ryman drank a swallow of wine, the sweat trickling down his cheek into his beard. "A sour man and in his cups," Catelyn thought. The late Lord Frey might be niggardly when it came to feeding his guests, but he did not stint on the drink. The ale, wine, and mead were flowing as fast as the river outside. The Great John was already roaring drunk. Lord Walder's son Merritt was matching him cup for cup, but Sir Weyland Frey had passed out, trying to keep up with the two of them. Catelyn would sooner Lord Umber had seen fit to stay sober, but telling the Great John not to drink was like telling him not to breathe for a few hours. Small John Umber and Robin Flint sat near Rob, to the other side of Fair Walder and Alex, respectively. Neither of them was drinking, along with Patrick Mallister and Daisy Mormont. They were her son's guards this evening. A wedding feast was not a battle, but there were always dangers when men were in their cups, and a king should never be unguarded. Catelyn was glad of that, and even more glad of the sword belts hanging on pegs along the walls. No man needs a longsword to deal with jellied calf's brains.
"Everyone thought my lord would choose Fair Walder," Lady Walder Bolton told Sir Wendell, shouting to be heard above the music.
Fat Walder was a round pink butterball of a girl with watery blue eyes, limp yellow hair, and a huge bosom, yet her voice was a fluttering squeak. It was hard to picture her in the Dreadfort, in her pink lace and cape of bear.
"My lord grandfather offered Roos his bride's weight in silver as a dowry, though, so my lord of Bolton picked me."
The girl's chins jiggled when she laughed.
"I weigh 6 stone more than Fair Walder, but that was the first time I was glad of it. I'm Lady Bolton now, and my cousin's still a maid, and she'll be 19 soon, poor thing."
The Lord of the Dreadfort paid the chatter no mind, Catelyn saw. Sometimes he tasted a bite of this, spoon of that, tearing bread from the loaf with his short, strung